The horse is a mirror. It's a mirror for us individually. It's a mirror for us as a tribe, and it's also a mirror of us for Indigenous people at large. One thing I heard exclusively throughout all the tribes is that the horse represented freedom.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure, this is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
This is the second episode with Erica Larsen here on Unfolding Maps. Last time we talked about her experiences in the Scandinavian Arctic, and this time I want to travel with her to another part of the world, which is America. We will explore the unique bond that exists between the horse and many Native American cultures. And I promise you that much, it's a very exciting journey. Have fun with our conversation. Hi, Erica. Welcome back to Unfolding Maps. Thank you so much for taking the time another time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
On your journey following the horse, you met a man called Jade Bronco, a member of the Shoshone Bannock tribe. And he told you, quote, "The horses are everything to us. They tell you when the season is going to change, when a storm is coming, when bad or good people are around. They are teachers, your best friend. It's a strong bond that cannot break," unquote. Last time we talked about the Sami people and the reindeers. And this time, obviously, we want to talk about a different topic, different people and different animals. How did it come that you were interested in the particular connection between humans, in this case Native Americans, and horses?
So this story actually was, it's kind of an interesting background. It came to me from two roads. So when I had, you know, kind of 3 years into that Sami work, I started working with a photo editor called Sarah Lean, who really supported my vision and the things that I've been doing. And so she called me for this story specifically. So this was created specifically in collaboration with National Geographic. And she said, "Are you ready to come back to the United States?" And I was like, well, going back and forth, she said, "Well, we have this story for you. We'd really like you to follow the horse into Native American culture and learn about this path and this connection." And so that's really the sort of the seed for the story or the catalyst for the story. But interestingly enough, so at the same exact time, my husband had a dream. And I remember I was home for about 2 weeks in between, from Norway to the US. I was home for a couple of weeks for some family things. I actually think it was for a small party for getting married. And my husband woke up and he said, Erica, he said, I've had this dream. And he said, so my husband's from Peru, just to give like context of it. And he said, he was like kind of nervous and he was, oh my goodness. He's like, I was dreaming and all the, you know, he said, I saw all these, indigenous people from his country, from Peru. So people, he's like, all these, you know, all indigenous, people from where I come from. And they were all, they just took you and took you away on horses. And he goes, and I was searching everywhere and I couldn't find you. And I kept getting these glimpses of you, like in this part and that part, always on horses. And it was really so, and this was before Sarah, my editor, called me from National Geographic. And I swear, like 2 days later, Sarah called me and said, "Erica, when are you coming back to the US? For good more. I was in the US, but when are you coming back to stay? Because we have this story for you that we'd love for you to do, to follow the horse into Native American culture." So it kind of came to me, I think, from both angles, but that was the beginning.
Was your husband worried when you told him about that you might actually be taken away by the horses?
No, I think he thought it was really, he was like, whoa, I think that's super interesting. He's a pretty, he's a pretty grounded person. So I think he was just like, wow, that's great. So
what was it beyond the dream about this story suggestion that interested you enough to actually make the decision to come back and do this story?
So, well, two things happened. My story in Norway had really completed its cycle. So I was in this process. And so actually I thought it was a really important way to come back to where I had been living and where I was born. But to come back through the horse and through the eyes of the indigenous people in the United States was extremely important, more than I could recognize, because it was like coming back to the U.S., but on a little bit kind of more profound ground. And so I had these brand new eyes that I had sort of grown over the last 4 years living in the Scandinavian Arctic. And all of a sudden to come back and to see the United States, but through the eyes of indigenous people. So it's almost a way to see my country in a way that I had never been taught about it before. And I think it was really imperative, actually. So it's almost like, yeah, coming back on virgin ground but getting a guided exploration of it through the eyes of indigenous people of this land. And, so for me, I feel like it was exactly the way I was meant to come back.
No. Did you yourself have experiences with horses by then? Do you have a special connection to these animals, or did you really start to dive more into the topic of horses and humans based on that story?
No, I mean, I had ridden some horses, and my husband has horses in Peru, a few, but no, it wasn't that I had this profound connection to horses. Which is great, I think, in a way, because I think like any of the stories I tend to open myself up to, I go in pretty open-minded because I don't have all these built-up expectations. So yeah. I really, and something really interesting is because of that too, like I really tried to let the horse guide me through Indian country. And I think that's really important. It's like the horse really became the guide into, whereas I feel like with the Sami, the people sort of guided me to understand the landscape and the reindeer. But I feel in this case, the horse sort of took me on its back and guided me through all the different territory. And yeah, it was very open. And no, I really didn't have a lot of experience with horses before.
How did that work, if you say the horse guided you, in quotation marks, through this project? How did you approach this project, and how did you decide where to start your journey and follow the horses?
So it kind of looked two ways. So at first, there's a prehistoric horse that's pretty prevalent in a lot of indigenous stories in the United States. And so that was, you know, that was one of the grounds I was thinking, okay, where do I start? So I researched that a bit, but my actual kind of trail started with the reintroduction of the horse with the Spaniards. So, south, moving its way north and like through the plains and up. So, I did it a little bit that way, just kind of trying to understand how the horse actually reintroduced itself, with the tribes. But, again, that was just the basis of looking at, okay, where can I actually start from? And that sort of got mixed around. I wouldn't say I followed that the whole way. So that was my beginning. And so I started, I think, down around in sort of Navajo country in the Southwest and worked my way up a bit.
I think that's already an interesting fact, the reintroduction of horses to the American continent, because I think many people don't know that Native Americans, at least the Plain tribes, like the tribes living in the Great Plains, for example, they have not always been horse people, right? It's not the case that it was historically always an essential part of their culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends who you ask. So, there's a lot of stories, especially the ones that I've heard, like Northern Cheyenne stories of this, you know, they were very much connected to this sort of prehistoric horse that was here, and they have stories of that. But yes, I think, you know, if you're talking about the past, whatever, 500 years or so, I mean, there was this reintroduction of the horse that literally transformed the indigenous connection to the landscape. I mean, rapidly. With the horse came so many changes and so much more movement and sort of, I don't know, just different interactions with the landscape that was, you know, unforeseeable before.
Yeah. What do horses symbolize in the cultures of Native Americans? Is that even possible to pinpoint? Probably it's also pretty different from tribe to tribe. But I think you try to talk to some of them about the symbolic meaning the horse has to them.
Well, yeah, this is pretty, it's right, it's not so straightforward. But in general, I will say this. One of my, again, sort of my main questions going into this. So I was there to look at this indigenous connection with the horse, with, you know, connection to landscape, economics, the spiritual connection, the like cultural connection, and also the ancestral story connection. And so these were all sort of the questions that I had going into it. And what I would say was that the horse is represented in every single part of these things. So you'll find it in creation stories. You'll find it existing in terms of the, you know, economics. Something as simple as people, a lot of different tribes do rodeo with horses. And this is a way to get a full scholarship to university. There's the spiritual connection with the horse. The idea that, just like you had sort of quoted what Jade had said, that, you know, the horse is I think I heard through many different tribes, the horse is a mirror. It's a mirror for us individually. It's a mirror for us as a tribe. And it's also a mirror of us for indigenous people at large. So there's that. It's a practical way to sustain themselves, you know, to go hunting on horseback is much more practical than some places where you can't get some sort of motorized vehicle. And obviously perhaps a bit faster than going on foot. A horseback can go quite a bit further. And another aspect I found really, really interesting is, if you want to say the horse as a reflection of certain, cultural identity. And one thing that I saw this was very specifically was in regalia. And there was this one young woman, Katie Harris, and she was incredible. She took a year off between her high school to her university, to sew her own regalia, her own, traditional clothing, and also that for her horse. And I asked her, you know, why would you take a year off to do this? And she said, well, there's a couple things. She goes, the minute our regalia is sitting in a museum, she goes, it's dead. She goes, it's only when it's living and breathing and we are wearing it that we are alive. These are her words. And she said, and you know what? I have regalia for my own dress and the dress of my horse that's been passed down to me from generations. She goes, but I am making history by sewing my own for today. This will be the history and the tradition and the culture and that connection for my children and my grandchildren. So she was probably, I don't know, 18 or 19 at the time when she was telling me this. And so that was really important. So there's the idea of the new and the old merging, and the idea that as you are creating new regalia using old designs but creating new designs, right? This kind of, there's this cross section of like living culture. It's not that everything and I saw this again with the Sami. It's not that everything has to be, you know, preserved in a box from 500 or 1,000 years ago. This is something that is living and growing and breathing today. And that is, all of these things are important to how we identify as indigenous people and in respect to their different tribes. So that was something she taught me. And, you know, so she basically, some of this was old stuff and a lot of it was brand new stuff that she created and will continue to create. And her dad took her hunting to get, and so basically this is elk skin that's been done by her and her father. And so it was incredible to see this.
It's a beautiful piece of work, like white leather and just very finely worked on her horse. You just showed me a beautiful photo of her with her horse all dressed up.
Yeah, and the beadwork as well. It's really interesting, right? It like it merges. It's like I said, some of it's old. Some of it's, you know, maybe I don't know how old, but couple hundred years maybe, or maybe not that old. I shouldn't say, I'm not sure the age, but some of it's, you know, and some of it was done, you know, a week before we took the photograph, and it doesn't matter. It's all bridging this, you know, it's all bridging time together. And like I've referred to before, like the magic of photography is can merge time together. And so can these, you know, these different types of artistic creations. That what I would say from Katie was really inspired by her connection to the horse.
Do you think you would be able to provide us with a photo for the show notes that, so that we can this way show it to our audience?
They
can
look it up themselves? Yeah, of course. Yeah, we can specifically have that picture. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, cool. Then I will just put it in. So for everyone listening, you can check it out on at unfoldingmaps.com and look at the photo that we just talked about. Very nice. Yeah, another photo that comes to mind now that we are talking about the really visually impactful connections of Native American tribes with horses in terms of traditions and history in this case, but in other cases, of course, also, for example, in terms of landscape. I'm just thinking of a photo, a very powerful one as well, and I'm also just looking at it right now, of a man called Jones Benally, a medicine man, right? And it shows him with a horse on a plane, and there's a lightning bolt in the background. So a pretty powerful display of nature, but at the same time, there's this intimacy between him, the man, and his animal. And it's a really magical photo for me. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's called Jones with Moonwalker. Moonwalker is the name of the horse. Yeah, that photograph. So it's super interesting. Actually, my connection with the Benally family was from, we have mutual Sami friends. So that, so everything's connected.
Yeah.
And Jones has a son, Clayton, who's also quite a horseman. So I went to spend time with their family several times over the years that I was working on the story. And, so Jones, had worked as a medicine man for years in Navajo territory and had, you know, we just went out that day to make a portrait. I wanted to photograph him with Moonwalker. And Moonwalker was a horse that was actually gifted to him from services he had provided for somebody. So there's this idea of this bartering system, right? Instead of paying cash like you would to a doctor, he was gifted a horse in exchange for the services he had provided for a family. And this was the horse. So, you know, as I was kind of looking to understand this connection with the horse better, he said, let's do a photograph with Moonwalker. And so we went out to an area in Navajo that he wanted to bring me to. And again, I was just looking to make maybe even a very still portrait of him with the horse. And then all of a sudden, there's this lightning storm happening behind me. And it was incredible. And I never, like, I just didn't even think it would, just didn't even think about what would come on the photograph. And we were going and taking pictures. And at one point, Jones says to me, well, did you get it? And I didn't even know what he meant. And he's like, I think you got it. And when I saw the photographs, I saw this beautiful kind of ray of lightning looking like it's hitting the back of the horse, right? Or it's emanating from the horse. However, obviously it didn't hit the horse. It was in the background. But I didn't even know. I mean, I was just photographing. And in I didn't see this till way after. But in the car, we actually took a car ride back. This was quite a bit from his home, the area. And he started talking to me about the connection. And he said that, you know, the horse, and I think specifically the white horse, had a connection to the lightning, and that it was born of the lightning. And that, you know, also that a lot of the power of the people of the Navajo people come from the horse. So I think, and again, these are just words that don't, I think, come across very well in English. Or I'm not translating the interpretation of what he was telling me very well. But I think if you see the photograph, perhaps you'll understand this. You know, I think he gave me that picture that day to show me what he was trying to show, the power of his connection and his people to this horse, and specifically the white horse. I think the photo sums it up, and my words are a very, very cheap interpretation of it.
Some other memorable encounters that you had were with Rosa and John Yearout, if I pronounced that correctly.
Mm-hmm.
They showed you their project in North Central Idaho, I believe. Who are they and what was their project all about?
So they were wonderful. They, Rosa and John live on the Nez Perce Reservation. Rosa is Nez Perce, and they have a group called the Nez Perce Appaloosa Horse Club. And what they do is every year, they take a group of youth from the community and, they complete one part of the Chief Joseph Trail Ride. And, if I remember correctly, the Chief Chauffeur Trail Ride, it goes continually over 7 years and then starts again. And this is basically the route that Chief Joseph took to lead his people away from the Calvary during the time that they were being pursued and pushed off and killed in their landscape. And so every year they take children on a part of this ride. And again, if I can summarize what one of the youth said to me, she said, when I asked all the youth, why do they do this ride? Why is it important? And she was 16 years old. And she said to me, when I get on the horse, she said, when I sit on the horse and I do this ride, I actually feel the suffering of my ancestors. And this brings me closer to my land and closer to who I am. And it's a way for me to communicate with all of the people, all of the things that have brought me to this moment now. And I thought that was really profound for a 16-year-old. And she said, you know, that main synergy was actually mounting the horse. It was the horse on the landscape and her on the horse that allowed her to sort of take this very profound journey to connect with her ancestral suffering and her ancestral passage into what she is today. And so the year outs do this every year, I think, as a way to awaken this connection with the past, present, and future for the youth.
Yeah, it's so meaningful what they told you about their relationship with their horses and what it really means to them. And I mean, you keep humbly mentioning that probably you don't do them justice with your words and rather like and try to do them justice with your photographic work. But it's still such an ambitious project to do that, right? To try to feel and to capture this kind of connection that they have and that they talked about through your lens. Are you even able to explain how you try to think about that challenge and how you try to do them justice with your photos?
Well, I think that if I'm really honest with myself, like what's happening is, like I said, I mean, I'm... Right. There's this idea of, you know, what is story? How do you tell stories? All of these, there's so many facets that go into it. And this is probably ever changing process, but if you're asking me right now, I would, in looking back on this experience, right, I would say that the horse, every person that's in my photographs, all the people that, you know, that I encountered over these couple years were my guides and my teachers to understand or try to better understand their vision of this landscape, their connection to the animal, their connection to the landscape. And actually what it did for me is really restructure my understanding of the land that I was born in. And that's really important. So that's when I'm looking, that's really what I'm trying to do. It's actually a restructuring and a perspective of my own new perspective of understanding these surroundings and this land that I had called, that I call home, right? And what does that really mean? What does home really mean? What does it mean for me to identify as a person in this landscape? But so to kind of, it's like, you know, you always trust your teachers in school and that's the way that you think you learn about the world. Well, it's really like going back to being 6 years old again and saying, look, these are my teachers. Please, you give me this. Please, you teach me to see this land and understand this history and understand how to even interpret your voice so I can see a vision of this anew. So that's what I think I'm doing. And I can only hope that my photographs are an extension of that learning.
And one of your teachers, I believe, was Leo Teton. He can also be probably considered as such. What did he teach you and tell you about the role of the horse in his family and his culture?
Oh, so Leo is great. Leo is like, yeah, I talk to him quite often still today. So actually it's Leo and his daughter, Randy L, and their whole family really opened up time for me. And I've been out several times to visit them over the years. Even after my project, I went and did a small piece on the Shoshone-Bannock tribe in relationship to the buffalo, and went out with Leo again. So we covered several things. He led a buffalo hunt for me on Shoshone-Bannock territory. We went out on a small elk hunt. We never made it so far, but we went out, we got the horses ready, and kind of went out to some territory where they would go elk hunting. And
if you talk about going to a buffalo hunt with him, can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, of course, I think we all know the majestic and impressive and also brutal scenes from like Dances with the Wolves and so on. Of course, probably today it's a little bit more humble, but I can imagine that it's still very impactful to be part of that process.
So there's really been this sort of, reacquiring and rewilding of the buffalo in the United States. And so a lot of different tribes have access again to get the buffalo back onto their land. So that where when we went buffalo hunting, it was on Shoshone Bannock territory specifically, because they also have like a tribal hunt in a different area in Wyoming. But we did it on the territory, on the reservation. And it was a small group of us, Leo, his daughter, some friends. They saddled up two horses and went out, and they did the hunt on horseback. And they took one buffalo, and there was a small ceremony before and afterwards. And all the meat was given out to the tribal elders. And I think the skull remained, I believe with his family. They kind of put them outside of their sweat lodge. And I think one or two years later, we actually did a sweat outside of that lodge. And and then right there, they took the buffalo, and they cut out the heart, and it's full of blood. And everyone that was on the hunt circled around, and we all took a drink of it, and it sort of closed off the process as a bit of reverence and thank you. And I think to that exchange of life. And it was beautiful. It was really beautiful to be on horseback as well and watch the hunt in that way. And Leo's been a really kind of very open teacher to me.
So beyond taking you on these hunts and making you a part of that, was he able to express to you his personal relationship to his horses and what they mean to him?
Yeah, I think for Leo, they're everything, right? They're connection to himself, connection to his landscape. He was involved with Indian relay racing forever. So, I mean, this is about action. It's about sport. It's about athleticism. It's about competition, rivalry, all of these things. It's about teaching. It's about passing on knowledge from elders to youth and bringing them up in this tradition of racing that gets them connected to everything, the language, the heart of what it means to be Shoshone and Bannock. And it's also a power. I think there's this connection to power that comes from a true sense of self. I think he showed me that as well. And I think the one thing and these are my words, not his, but I think the horse imparts a great amount of generosity on the people. And therefore I saw this immense generosity in the people themselves. And I think that's, I think often we'll hear that, we're a mirror of the horse, or I hear this a lot, or that the horse teaches us how to be. And I think this great generosity, the horse as a teacher will therefore passes through the people and then even trickles down. So
you mentioned the races that Leo, I believe, also participates in and that you also watched. And I mean, these races are really amazing, aren't they? These horses are ridden completely without a saddle, bareback, as far as I know. And it just looks very impressive and also a little bit scary.
Yeah, I mean, they're beautiful. I mean, oh my goodness. First of all, it's like you're looking at just like prime athletes, right? You're not doing these Indian relay races if you're like loafing around watching TV all day. These are like prime athletes, people in really, really physically great shape, and also like their horse. Yeah, they're riding bareback. They've and it's really interesting. People talk about breaking horses, which I heard often is quite a quite a, you know, sort of Occidental term to use, but it's this idea of that you and the horse become one. So it's not this idea that you're breaking the horse or breaking the spirit of the horse. You're actually connecting to the horse. And that's how you're able to just ride it with such fluidity, or that you can trust that you're just going to jump on this horse going as quickly as it is, like bareback. Yeah. It's because you've had this ability to sort of merge and understand it, right? Think about how you would trust your, you know, like, you know, trust a family member close to you to like hold your arm as you're like, or I don't know, think about rope climbers or mountain climbers, you know, you trust the person that's helping you belay down. It's like, as much like that, it's this really intimate connection of trust, but that only comes with like, you know, again, not breaking somebody to get that trust, but to merge with somebody and try to have the utmost respect and understanding. So it was that. And yeah, and just, it's honestly, it's like really fast. It's really exciting. And if people win, they get, you know, I think they get a lot of pride and status on their tribe, but they also can make money, and they can make money to keep their horses. That's, you know, horses can be costly. So to, you know, keep their horses in good shape. And like I said, some of this, you know, sometimes if you're pretty good in Indian relay, you might be involved in rodeo as well, which ultimately could lead to great opportunities to make a good economic living, and also to, if you want to go on to university or other things. So, so yeah, there was a lot of, I mean, being, you know, being connected to the horse in this way was really, really beautiful, really practical, really exciting as well. And yeah, it was great. I loved it.
At this point that you made about not breaking the horses, that brings me back to Joan Spinelli, the medicine man with a photo with a lightning bolt and his horse, and his son Clayson, that you, I believe, also mentioned already a little bit earlier on. I think he also told you, right, that if it comes to young or green horses, he said, we don't want to break the horse. I need to understand them. And I believe you also showed you how such a work looks like, to get into a kind of synchronization with such a young horse, and to actually, yeah, to try to understand them instead of breaking them.
Yeah, Clayson said to me that, you know, there's this, you kind of, the idea, again, yeah, that you're not breaking the horse, you're building this bond. Yeah. And he said that happens by you breathing on the horse and the horse breathing back to you. That's the sort of first step. And yeah, then it's step by step by step, riding it a little bit. And but it's like, it's really building trust, and building trust is this exchange of breath.
I would like to very briefly discuss another topic that maybe is not directly related to the horse project. But as far as I know, you were also at the Dakota Access Pipeline protests that took place in, I believe, 2016. Or 17?
Yes.
I think 16. It was the largest.
2016 and 17. So.
Yeah, I believe it was the largest gathering of indigenous people in the world for quite a long time, right? Why did you decide to go there? With which questions, maybe, that you wanted to find answers for?
So, again, it's twofolded. I was, you know, I was working with National Geographic as well on that. Mm-hmm. But one of the families that I worked with pretty intimately with on the horse story, that I met in 2011, Lynette Tubles and Philip Whiteman, I've become quite close with their daughter, Crystal Tubles. And she was working at the time, sort of as this communication liaison for Red Warrior Camp, which was one of the three kind of main camps at the time that was set up. And we were talking, and so she invited me and said that, you know, I would sort of get the perspective of what was going on in Standing Rock through the eyes of Red Warrior Camp. So I specifically was working with that group, at least the first time that I went out. And I went with her. And yeah, I mean, this was super important. Everybody that went to Standing Rock literally, I believe, heard. There's so many things being said at Standing Rock, so many messages, so much energy, so many important kind of manifestations. But I, right, this is the idea of the storyteller and the story and the audience and all these things. But we're all going to hear something a little bit different. So what all I can say is what I kept being told, me personally, was that we are experiencing actually like part of a great awakening, and that, you know, since colonization, and especially in the Americas, there had been this kind of time of going to sleep, right? Which maybe could ultimately physically represent as like a separation of landscape as well, right?
Yeah.
And this experience in many, many different ways that we probably all know about, which loss of language, loss of connection to like actual loss of land, loss of all, you know, all of these, loss of freedom. And that's important too, because one thing I heard exclusively throughout all the tribes is that the horse represented freedom. So that's actually really interesting as a symbol. Yeah. I think every tribe told me that the horse represents freedom. But anyway, so I kept hearing this Standing Rock was this time of awakening, and basically that people were remembering again how to translate the landscape, remembering how to believe in their role as stewards and part and an integral part of everything around them. And they said they would actually perhaps remembering again a language. They were remembering a language, and perhaps at the same time they were learning a new language. And that Standing Rock for them was like the awakening of the great giant of this time period. And then, you know, that's why, you know, the North and South came together, why people from everywhere were drawn, because this is like, you know, this was just one of the epicenters of it, but it's something that was, you know, kind of popping up everywhere in the world.
Why I believe it was much more than a moment of resistance to protect the environment and to be ecologically responsible, but it was for them really also a moment of identity, right? Where they came together and shared these goals.
Yeah, I call it just greater than a pipeline.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's better to just hear pipeline, but it was greater than a pipeline. And yes. It was, yes, it's that. It was, you know, that, but also it was many, many, it was really, really multifaceted. Yeah. And I think for me, especially with such a deep interest in people that can interpret, you know, our changing environment, not only physical environment, but are actually changing consciousness and changing cultural and social structures. I think it was imperative to go to Standing Rock and to have even a small opportunity to listen to that.
And it was for me another great opportunity to listen to you. I just want to refer back to what you also said during the past few minutes. The horse is a symbol of freedom for them. I think that is very beautiful. Did you get this feeling personally as well? You as a visitor who doesn't have this decades-old connection to the horses, did you also get this a sense of freedom when riding them, when touching them, being with them from that trip?
Yeah, what I would say is that writing is just what you define freedom as. Mm-hmm. And if I define freedom as greater understanding of what it means to be human, then yes, because I got such an intimate and open reception and guidance into, you know, what this connection represented. And I think ultimately helped me to, right? Like, it's like reframing a structure in a completely different way of what this landscape of what we call, you know, sort of North America is. So I think that's right. That sort of, if you want to say that sort of guidance down that path is a beautiful freedom, because, you know, with the more, I don't know if I'm phrasing it right, but that's, I don't know. I don't really have the words. What I mean is that the opportunity to get to like restructure the way that you see and understand the landscape that I maybe only had, you know, it just gives me this profound different way of understanding this landscape. Like that's ultimate freedom, right? Because you begin to be able to translate history different. You begin to be able to translate. I keep saying this, it's like learning another language. Maybe that language that they were talking about that we're coming into, remembering an old language, but perhaps it's the forming of a new language.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe this is just the openness of being, for people being able to communicate freely and openly their perspective on their experience in the world. Like that is actually like a new language. Because that's been repressed for many people in so many different ways. So I think they gave me that gift to communicate in that way with me and to show me this small glimpse, like that's one part of freedom.
Yeah. And I believe that is a little bit related to the kind of freedom that you also searched and found with the Sami people, right? Because you also benefited from them showing you how they perceive and experience their landscape, because of course their way of life is also strongly influenced by the surrounding and by the environment that they live and work and hunt in.
Absolutely. And isn't that, I mean, I guess for me, that's what living is about. Like if I could say like my core sort of importance of being alive is mm-hmm. just having a better understanding of what it means to be human in this really physical kind of manifestation of this, yeah. of this life that we're having. And so every time you can have a sort of intimate guided interpretation of a specific culture, of a specific landscape, of a specific, you know, vision of the world, like that just puts, I'd say, like one more layer of beauty into my understanding of the sort of human fabric.
Yeah, it's incredibly enriching. And so was our conversation, at least for me. And Erica, once again, I want to thank you very much for taking the time for the second time. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.